This is the class that would have taken place on Sunday, May 10th, the PM, that is the evening session. Let me repeat that. This is the class in our Everyday with God Bible reading and review that would have taken place on Sunday, May 10th, the evening, that is the PM session. In our Sunday morning class, we got through 2 Kings 21. We're going to take up with 2 Kings 22, and we're going to get up to 1 Chronicles chapter 6 in this review. We left off at the end of chapter 21 with the wicked king Manasseh. He was worse than any of the kings in the south and is compared to being like the kings in the north because of his wickedness. He put pagan idols inside the temple. He offered his children as sacrifices through fire. Just an incredibly wicked guy. And because of that, God determined to send the southern kingdom into Judah. At the end of that chapter, 2 Kings 21, Manasseh is no longer king, and Amon, his son, is going to rule over Judah. But he was a wicked king, as was his father. And the chapter ends with Josiah becoming king. And so we take up in chapter 22 of 2 Kings. So Josiah began his rule at the age of 8. And if you read through the circumstances as to how that happened, we saw earlier kings that reigned and started at a very young age. And usually they had mentors that are going to work with them. And we're going to see that in the context of 2 Kings chapter 22. So he becomes king. When he's 8, he's going to reign for 31 years. And we see his life described in verse 2. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord, walked in all the ways of his father David, did not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. And so of all of the kings after David, Hezekiah and Josiah were very, very righteous. Josiah even more so than was Hezekiah. And then there were six kings that tended in that direction. So they are all compared to how righteous they are with the life of David. So while he was king, there was a session of repair work that was done in the temple. We see that in verses 4 and following. And sometime during the 18th year of his rule, Hilkiah, who's serving as a high priest, discovers the law of the Lord within the temple. That raises lots of different questions. How could it have been discovered in the temple? Certainly the law of the Lord, whatever form of it existed, a written copy, would have been very prominent in the worship and also in the reading and the study and just, you know, the constant mindfulness of the priest. But in some sense, it had been lost, and we're going to see more about the significance of that as we go forward. The law of the Lord is language that could refer to several different things. It could refer to the Ten Commandments itself. It could refer to the entire body of the laws, the statutes, the ordinances, and so forth that make up the law. So that would be the Ten Commandments plus all the civil, business, family, relationships, all of those things that are discussed after the law was initially introduced in Exodus chapter 20. And so, or it could refer to any one of the many commandments that are given in the context of the law of Moses. In this instance, the law of the Lord had primary reference to the codification, that is, the writing of these laws, which Moses recorded, and which was placed within, that is, inside the Ark of the Testimony. And we see details about that brought out in the book of Deuteronomy. Somehow or another, the law of the Lord was not continually within the Ark of the Testimony. Do not know how that happened, why that happened, but how, you know, that took place is not mentioned, not in this context. We note that, remember, when the ark was carried into battle against the Philistines, that when it came back, the people of Beth Shemesh opened it. Did they take anything? I don't know. But at some point, the contents of the ark, as initially described, are not the contents of the ark as later described. And so it was lost, and evidently for some period of time. So when the book of the law of the Lord was found, Shaphan the scribe showed it to the king. Again, remember Josiah, the last righteous king, and the most righteous king since David. When Josiah heard the law in his presence, he tore his clothes. That's a sign of concern, of mourning, and so forth. And he sought to know the will of the Lord with regard to those commands. So notice what he says in verse 13. Great is the wrath of the Lord that's kindled against us, because our fathers, and he doesn't mean just literal fathers, but our ancestors, those who preceded us, for our fathers have not hearkened, that is, they haven't listened to the word of this book, to do according to all that which is written concerning us. So note, he refers to the previous generation's sins were spoken of as having the potential to cause wickedness in the future generations. Just a reminder, Solomon's sins was the break point at which God said, that's it, I'm going to divide the kingdom. Just recently, Manasseh's sins were the break point, the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back, in which God said, the southern kingdom is going to go into captivity. And so what has happened in the past, there's an emphasis on cumulative nature of sin that builds up to the point where God's not going to tolerate it anymore. We see that mentioned in our lesson as we're talking about things that are different in the context of Chronicles, that there is an immediate awareness of sin and immediate accountability of sin individually, not just nationally. That's emphasized more in Chronicles than we saw in the context of the book of Kings. So note, previous generation sins were spoken of as having the potential to cause wickedness in future generations. And then the last section of the book, this chapter, portrays the predictions of Huldah. She was a prophetess who confirmed that this was indeed the book of the law of the Lord that was found in the temple. It was told to Josiah that the nation of Judah would indeed perish because of the sins of the children of Israel, the culminating sins, as we just noted, that of Manasseh, but that Josiah himself would be gathered to his grave in peace, and in his eyes would not see the evil that would come upon the country of Judah, meaning that it's going to happen after him. So if you read through the account of the finding of the book of the law in verse 3, and following, you see it's very, very dramatic, and you see the response that Josiah had. And so in the culminating remarks of Huldah said, here's what the Lord says, I'm going to bring calamity on this place. Verse 16, why? Well, the reason why these things happen in 2 Kings that we've noted before with reference to the northern kingdom are going to be mentioned here with reference to the southern kingdom. Because they've forsaken me. They've burned incense to other gods. I'm reading verse 17 of chapter 22. That they might provoke me to anger with all the works of their hands. Therefore my wrath shall be aroused against this place and shall not be quenched. But as for the king of Judah, Josiah, who sent you to inquire of the Lord, in this manner you shall speak to him, thus says the Lord God of Israel concerning the words which you have heard, because your heart is tender. So because he was right in God's sight in his intention and what he's about to do in practice, because you've humbled yourself, you're not going to see these things. You will die before they come to pass. So that's just the first part of what's going to be even more dramatic. I mean, it's dramatic enough that they discover the law of the Lord in the temple, but what's going to be even more dramatic is that Josiah does something about it. So let's look at the summary notes of chapter 23. Josiah begins to institute one of the most far-reaching reforms that Judah had ever witnessed, even more so than what we noticed with reference to Hezekiah earlier. He calls all the people together. He reads in their hearing all the words of the book of the covenant, which was found in the temple complex. Starting in verse 1, we read this. And following the reading, Josiah makes an agreement, makes a covenant before God with the people to keep the commands of the covenant of the law. Not just Josiah, but I just mentioned, Josiah read it to the people, But the covenant is with the Lord, including Josiah and the people as participants. The people also subscribe to the covenant to follow the law of the Lord. So we're going to do what God wants us to do. So starting in the fourth verse, we see Josiah's reforms start to be implemented. The vessels that were made for the worship of Baal that were inside of the house of the Lord were thrown out. How'd all that stuff get there? Well, just a reminder, before Ammon was Manasseh, and Manasseh was wicked enough that he had images brought into the temple and also offered his child as a human sacrifice, one of them. And so at some point that happened. So all those things are thrown out. The high places of pagan worship were destroyed. The high priest of Baal were slain. Just going back into history, we saw Jehu, the king in the north, was used of God. He was prophesied by Elijah, anointed by Elisha to be a king in the northern kingdom. And his job description included the eradication of the household of Ahab because of their wickedness, persecution of the prophets, including Jezebel, that is his wife, and the worship of Baal, and also the prophets of Baal, not just the ones that were lost in the contest with Elijah at Mount Carmel, but all the other worshipers of Baal were gathered together and were destroyed under Jehu. That was in the northern kingdom. This is in the southern kingdom. And so Baal worship didn't fade away because of what Jehu did in the north. They were still worshipers of Baal, obviously, in other nations, but even in the southern kingdom. And so places of pagan worship were destroyed. High priests of Baal were killed. Pagan places of worship that Solomon had established. Now, this goes back. This goes way back. We are getting near the end of the history of the children of Judah, the southern kingdom that divided after Solomon. So David is roughly 1,000 years before. Solomon's going to be about 960 or so years before. So, you know, somewhere in that range. And now we are in the 600. So we're 300 plus years down the road, hundreds of years earlier. Some of the things that Solomon had instituted, remember, because of the idolatry of his wives and his support of the idolatry of his wives and the building of pagan temples and that sort of thing, God said, that's it, the southern kingdom is going to be destroyed. And so some of that stuff has still remained. And so they're now being destroyed by Josiah. In addition to the eradication, destruction, all these false kinds of worship, Josiah sees to it that what God originally intended in worship was going to be restored. So what God commanded initially and had been forgotten, they're going to be restored to the practice of the Jewish people, the nation of Israel. So we see one example of that, very dramatic. The Passover again began to be practiced among the nation of Judah. That's the first feast that was inaugurated, initiated in real time at the time of the Passover itself, when the Lord passed over the firstborn of Israel because of the blood of the lamb that was on the cross post and the side post, and then it was going to be commemorated annually after that. And so that's the first one. Well, it hadn't been kept like it was supposed to have been kept. This goes back even further than the time of Solomon. So roughly, again, I emphasize roughly, the period of the Exodus, the time of Moses, Moses lived 120 years, so these are rough numbers, is about 1,500 years prior to the time of Christ. And so this is about 900 years after the fact, 900 plus years. And so that's the first feast that they were, children of Israel were to commemorate after they came out of the land of Egypt, the last plague being the death of the firstborn of man and beast. So that was commanded again, perhaps as long, 900, 1,000 years before this. According to verse 22, there had not been such a Passover observed since the days of the judges. That does not mean nobody kept the Passover at all, but it had not been kept as thoroughly, as completely, as going back to the time of the judges, which precedes Solomon, which precedes David, which precedes Saul. And so this goes back within, you know, 50 to 100 years after the period of the conquest. And so we're a little bit further into the history of Israel. But the point is, they had not done what God wanted them to do for a long, long time. So this great deficiency in worship among the Jews simply tells us the depths of the disobedience which they had plunged initially and then repeated on an ongoing basis, so that it became a continual problem. Even though Josiah instituted many reforms that were good for the people of Judah, the Lord was still going to destroy the nation of the southern kingdom of Judah because of what Manasseh did. Just a reminder, we mentioned it already. The trigger that prompted the division from God's perspective was Solomon's in 1 Kings chapter 11 because of the multitude of wives and what they did to encourage him, or he did willingly to support their idol worship. That was the trigger. Now Manasseh is the trigger. Didn't happen during Manasseh's life. Didn't happen during Amon's life. It's not going to happen during Josiah's life, but it is going to happen. Then toward the end of the chapter, verses 28 and following, Josiah dies, and we see the beginning of the reign of Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah. We are getting near the end of the kingdom in the north. Jehoahaz only reigns for a period of 3 months, but he still had time to do evil on the side of the Lord. In spite of all the incredible stuff that his father had done, his son doesn't follow suit. Pharaoh Necho, who is the king of Egypt, comes to Judah, and he puts Jehoahaz in bondage and made his brother Eliakim, who's going to be called Jehoiakim, watch the names there, Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim are brothers, but they're not the same. Their names sound alike. He's going to become a king over Judah. So notice, in spite of the incredible restoration and worship and things by Josiah in the land of Judah, that doesn't continue very long after his death. And moreover, we see that the weakening politically, militarily of the southern kingdom of Judah is alluded to in that they are paying tribute to Pharaoh Necho. And so he puts one brother in bondage, made another brother king, and that's Jehoiakim, K-I-M with an M. And so according to verse 35, Jehoiakim paid great amounts of silver and gold as tribute. So this is one of the things you do to keep a conquering king, or in this case, a conquering pharaoh, happy, you pay. And so Jehoiakim rules in Judah for 11 years, and he's wicked like kings that are before him. So I don't want to go into all of the details that are addressed in this chapter, but I would encourage you to read, I know you have already done so, but read slowly through all of the things that Josiah did in the context of getting the worship of Judah back to where it was. And so it starts in verse 4. He gets a commandment by the people to be obedient. It starts in verse 4 of chapter 23, where he gets rid of all the articles that were involved for Baal and Asherah, worship to them. That's the male and female counterparts of what are generally regarded as earth gods or fertility gods. And that they had so many different things that were created in honor of, in worship of, all of the quote-unquote host of heaven. Carried them out, had them thrown out. Got rid of idolatrous priests that kings of Judah had ordained to do all of these things in all these pagan places of sacrifices. So there's a system of pagan priests there. Took down the wooden image that was in the house of the Lord and had that burned. And remember, going back to Manasseh, his wickedness. Got down the ritual booths of the perverted persons. These were places in which prostitution was practiced in the context of the worship of these pagan gods that were in the house of the Lord, where the woman wove hangings for the wooden image. So if you look in the details that are brought out starting in chapter 4 and following, it's pretty intense. From the standpoint of all the things that were done, altars that were on the roof, the chamber of Ahaz, which the kings of Judah had made, and the altars that Manasseh had made in the courts of the house, got rid of them. So it's very, very extensive, and I'm not going to read through all of that. So at the end of chapter 23, Josiah is dead. One son had been king for a short period of time. He is in prison, put in bondage by Pharaoh Necho, and he makes his brother Jehoiakim king, and he's wicked. And he's keeping Pharaoh Necho at bay, in part, because he's paying him tribute. Chapter 24, time is closer and closer to the fulfillment of God's great wrath upon Judah that had been warned by prophets for hundreds of years, up to 300 years. And the linchpin, the pivot point at which God determined it's definitely going to happen was that of Manasseh, that is his wickedness. So the opening verses of the chapter tell us that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, what's he doing? Well, the Assyrian kings that we saw mentioned before, Pul, Tiglath-Pileser, Sennacherib, and so forth, they're no longer the dominant world empire. That goes back a little more than a century before when the northern kingdom was taken into captivity. Pharaoh Necho weakens them, but at this point, the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, is going to make inroads against the southern kingdom. So that king, Nebuchadnezzar, comes against Judah and subdues it for a period of 3 years. And after that, Jehoiakim rebelled. And so Jehoiakim, paying tribute to Pharaoh Necho, now he is forced to submit to king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. And so the Chaldean armies, the Syrians, the Moabites, children of Ammon, come out against Judah to destroy it. So you got lots of people in alliance that are fighting against Judah at this point. So they're not only weakening, they are about to fall. So Jehoiakim dies. And notice the similarity of name, Jehoiakim. Kim, K-I-M, the first son of, he's the first one that was king was Jehoahaz. And then Jehoiakim, also known as Eliakim, was made king by Pharaoh Necho. And now he dies, and Jehoiakim, his son, is going to reign. We learn from verse 7 of this chapter the reason why the king of Egypt came no longer against the nation of Judah. Well, why? All of a sudden we saw Pharaoh Necho in control of everything, and then it's Nebuchadnezzar, two different kings of two different countries. Well, that's because by this point in time, Egypt had been conquered by Babylon. So lots of stuff going on a world stage. Just as a reminder, if you look on a map, Egypt's on one side, Babylon's on another. And so, you know, there's a sense in which Judah's caught in the middle. So Jehoiakim, not Kim, begins reigning at the age of 18, only rules for 3 months before Nebuchadnezzar comes against the city of Jerusalem and laid siege to it. This is a common way in which you wait out and defeat a nation that you're fighting against. You surround it with armies and you wait them out. People can't go in, people can't go out. There were viaducts, tunnels of water that come in that go back to the time of Hezekiah. But at some point, the waiting period is going to be long enough that people can't handle it anymore. People are dying inside. They can't get out in, can't get out, so forth. But anyway, he comes against the city of Jerusalem and lays siege to it. Jehoiakim surrenders to Nebuchadnezzar, and he and a great host of his family and those who were working with him, then the treasures of the city, temple treasures, king's treasures, they're all carried away, right? Off to Babylon. And then Mattaniah, later Zedekiah, was made king over Judah by the king of Babylon. So now he's appointing people who are to be kings. Now we're going to see later that Jeremiah had prophesied. It's already happened in the context of history, but we don't see it recorded in this context of kings. We'll see it when we get to Chronicles. Now, Jeremiah prophesied that at some point there would no longer be any king's descendant of David reigning on the throne in Jerusalem. They existed in name. They existed from the standpoint of genealogy. Matthew and Luke allude to that. But none of them are ruling anymore. So Zedekiah begins to rule at the age of 21, rules for 11 years in Jerusalem. As was Jehoiakim before him, so was Zedekiah, a wicked king. He later rebels against Nebuchadnezzar. So read through chapter 24. For much more detail about what's going on. I mentioned before about the treasures that are carried out. Notice verse 13, I just alluded to this in the outline. But in verse 13, it specifically says, he carries out from there, that is Babylon, all the treasures of the house of the Lord, that's the temple, and the treasures of the king's house. And he cuts in pieces all the articles of gold which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, as the Lord had said. So if you go back and you look at the description of the temple, you see all the incredible stonework that's on the outside, covered with all the cedar and the reference to Cyprus in some points on the inside, and all of that was covered with gold and images of gold. And so it's just gold, 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 gold everywhere. And so some of those things that were in the king's house going as far back as Solomon, again, this is 350 to 400 years, that's stripped from the temple, and that's taken, and it's taken into Babylon. And then Zedekiah is going to become king. Just as a note, that he is the uncle of Mattaniah. So he's still in the seed line, but he's not a son. That's brought out in verse 17. All right, so chapter 25, the last chapter in 2 Kings, opening section, first seven verses, depicts the account of the fall of the city of Jerusalem. Just quick overview here. The beginning of the fall of Jerusalem, that is, the first wave of captivity happens roughly 606 BC. That's about 116 years or so after the fall of the northern kingdom, when Samaria was taken captive. And over the next 20 years, there are three successive waves of people taken captivity by the Babylonians, starting in 606. Daniel and Ezekiel and all of those young men that we see referenced in their own books, the book of Daniel, obviously, the book of Ezekiel, obviously, are carried away. The kings, the families, the workers are carried away. And 20 years in, it's not only another carrying away, but the city is destroyed and the temple is destroyed. And so the fall of Jerusalem doesn't happen the first time that Babylon is oppressing and putting kings up and bringing kings down and exacting tribute from Judah. This is a successive thing that's going on. It's going on over a period of time. So the city's still standing, but at this point we're going to see that's going to be destroyed. So this takes place during the time of Zedekiah, who was an uncle of Jehoiakim, the last king. He subsequently carried off to captivity in the land of Babylon. His sons are killed before him, and then he's blinded, in part because he tried to escape. The tales of that are brought out in chapter 25. Following part of the chapter depicts the actual fall of the nation of Judah, which is culminating with the fall of the city of Jerusalem. The fall of the city of Samaria represents the fall of the nation of Israel in the north. Nebuzaradan, a captain of the guard of the Babylonian army, comes to Jerusalem and destroys the temple. Many of the people of the country were carried away into captivity, leaving behind only the poor. This is one of the things that we noted earlier in chapter 17 and or so of 2 Kings, when the northern kingdom was conquered. One of the things that conquering kings did was repopulate people from all of the other nations that were defeated, and they would scatter them. So they would take, you know, X percentage, 85-90% of the people, and scatter them to other nations, leaving behind only a small percentage. But then they would repopulate the area with other peoples from other nations that hadn't been defeated. So you don't have a homogeneous unit of all people from X nation in that nation. They're scattered all over the place. So the Jews are scattered, but they're not the only ones that are scattered. Other people are scattered as well. And so, generally speaking, Judah is carried away out of their land. Some people remain, but in large measure, the people were displaced. And the people that were there were obviously not able to fend off the Babylonians, and no more kings are going to be raiding. So the last section of the chapter tells us about the remnant, that is the seed, the root, the stem, lots of different language used, especially when we get to Isaiah and Jeremiah, that Judah remains in existence, but it's just a threadbare representation of the whole cloth, so to speak, that it used to be. So after the capture of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar makes Gedaliah ruler over the land. So he's a ruler, but he's not a king. He's later going to be killed by Ishmael. As a result of the people fled the land and they go into Egypt, something that's going to be spoken of when we get into the prophecy of Jeremiah. That section of the chapter also tells us of the restoration of Jehoiakim in the land of Babylon, that he finds favor in the sight of the king of Babylon, and is elevated, not returned to be king in Israel, but he's recognized and respected a little bit later while he is in captivity. And so the restoration does not mean he becomes king in Jerusalem over Judah, but he is no longer as oppressed as a prisoner as he was before. So we mentioned in our reviews of basic messages of kings that everything starts off just incredible with David committing to Solomon a respect for God's word and God's worship. That continues through 1 Kings chapter 10, chapter 11, the tendency of Solomon to support idolatrous worship because of his wives and so forth. That's the key point at which God says, that's it, I'm going to destroy Judah. And from there, everything goes downhill. The kingdom divides. The northern kingdom is never righteous, starting with the sins of Nebat, Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. At the end of 1 Kings, he's prophesied by Ahijah to be blessed, as David was blessed, if he's faithful. And that faithfulness never happened. And so the northern kingdom is going to fade away religiously very quickly. Some people will leave there. More about that when we get to the books of Chronicles. And then the southern kingdom is hit and miss. You have two very, very righteous kings after David. And you have six fairly righteous kings. But of all the kings over that 400-year span, that's not a whole lot of righteous kings. And so Judah's going to be trailing behind, but that's going to happen. So there's a decline. So 1 Kings goes from the close of the reign of David to the point of the division of the kingdom. And then that book takes us from that point to the date of when they're going to be into captivity. First one to go into captivity was Israel, northern kingdom. We saw that in chapter 15 of 2 Kings. And then the book concludes with the captivity of the nation of Judah, the southern kingdom. So very quick history from David to the end of the southern kingdom in those two books. It's just a decline. And in between all of these things, The opening of the book and the conclusion of each of the kingdoms, we're informed of the great works of prophets Elijah, Elisha, Isaiah is referred to. His book will, of course, refer to more about what he does when we get to that book itself, and Jeremiah and others. The theme of the first section of the book is found within this book as well. God's not interested in judging the ultimate outcome of any ruler by the social, political, and economic reforms that were instituted. Some of them are great. Solomon's political connections, business connections, expanding of the territory. Those are just absolutely fantastic. But God's going to judge Solomon and all others based upon whether or not they worshiped God correctly and followed God's word. And so God didn't care about those things. I mean, they are great, and they were blessings in part because of what God allowed. But God was concerned more about the religious welfare of the kings. And so compared to David, it was a comparison not to David as a military leader, a political leader, and so forth, the expanse of his kingdom. The comparisons to David were based upon whether or not they were faithful in word and worship, as was David. And so that's what he was concerned about, both Judah and Israel. And not just the kings, but the nations whom they led, Judah and Israel, respectively. Though a man may have ruled for a period of 40-plus years in his life, it may be summed up in just a few verses, the conclusion of which is that he either walked wickedly in the sight of the Lord, or he was righteous, as was David. Important lesson comes across. To us, makes no difference how much or how many great accomplishments we might reach in life. We could be likable, excellent workers on the job, diligent providing for the needs of our family. But if we're not righteous in God's sight, then we've missed something. And that's just dramatic. It's not enough to be successful in worldly, secular, measured ways. But are we righteous? If righteousness was expected of those who were the kings of Judah and the people, and the kings of Israel and the people, you can rest assured that God wants no less of us today. Also, in the context of 2 Kings, we notice the origin of what would later become the province of Samaria. The city of Samaria was the naming of what was once known as Sebaste. It became the capital city of the kings during Jeroboam's day. But it's going to develop into a middle region between Judah in the south and Galilee in the north before the time of Christ. But that's what is going to be the geographical distinctions when we get to the period of the first century. Throughout the book, we're introduced to both righteous and wicked kings, usually more of the latter, always the latter in the northern kingdom, and a lot of the latter in the southern kingdom. Depths of sin to which Jews had fallen is perhaps best seen in the almost total disregard for the laws of the Lord, which are reformed during the time of Josiah's reign. Later, we also see within the book, or that is within the book, we see the emphasis on the continued seed line of David. That's a big deal as you're reading through the text. More about that when we get into Chronicles. We saw hints of that in the book of Ruth in the concluding chapters, where Ruth and Boaz give rise to children that are going to be in the immediate seed line of David. And so David's grandfather and then David's father and then David are all chronicled in the end there. Remember that it's through that seed line, the Davidic seed line, that the Messiah is going to be born. In addition to that, we're once again made aware of the choice between blessings and cursings. That's a big, big message in the book of Deuteronomy. If you obey me, I will bless you. If you don't obey me, I will not bless you. So that's a Mosaic thing going back long before the period of Judges and the period of the kings and the division of the kingdom and the ultimate demise of them. This principle of blessings and curses based upon obedience or disobedience, that's just a long-standing principle of God, going back to the Garden of Eden. But especially so in the context of Israel's history to the days of Moses. So it may have been difficult for the children of Israel to fully realize the import of what God said then, but they're going to learn it over time, or they did learn it over time. They came into the land of Canaan, and God expected them to continue to be faithful to him. Just because they got there doesn't mean everything's done. Now they have to be faithful. So now, hundreds of years after the fact of leaving Egypt, that's going back to Moses, so that's roughly 1,500 years. Now we're 600 years before the time of Christ. So you've got a 900-year span, and it's going to be another 70 years before they return to the land of Canaan. You'd think they would have learned that lesson. And so, not necessarily so. Every generation is going to be different as to their devotion or lack thereof to service to God. So, Northern Kingdom goes into captivity of the Assyrians, and the Southern Kingdom of Judah goes into the captivity of the Babylonians. Again, we're just surveying these chapters. We would need to take some time to look at them in much more detail to become more fully conversant with them, but part of that we've done in the context of our own reading. So, Chronicles is next in the Hebrew Bible, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, as were Samuel, as were Kings, and in fact, Samuel Kings altogether were often considered a unit. But in the Hebrew Bible, 1st and 2nd Chronicles are one book. These two books deal with the same period, generally speaking, of the books of 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings, especially so with 1st and 2nd Kings. The book of Chronicles, 1st Chronicles, opens by dealing with extensive genealogical lists and continues to discuss the reign of King David. So we notice that already in our lesson for Sunday morning, May 10th, that 50% of the books of Chronicles is right out of Samuel and right out of Kings. So that means there's 50% that's not, but half of it thereabouts is retelling, rehashing for a different purpose, from a different perspective, the history of Israel that we have already seen in Samuel and Kings. So why the similarity? More about that as we go forward. Why the differences? We've introduced that again in our lesson on Sunday morning. I encourage you to take note of those slides and the audio that is already on the site. So what we're going to see in the opening chapters of Chronicles is going to be a huge, huge dose of genealogy. Why? Well, that's a good question. Why? Genealogies in the book of Matthew, yeah, we're jumping ahead to the New Testament, are to establish a connection between individuals of the past, starting with David and Abraham in the first verse of Matthew, to lead to a connection that is of significant importance later in history, hundreds of years later. I mean, obviously, 1,000 years before the time of Christ was David, and roughly, again, rough numbers here, 1,000 years before the time of David was Abraham. And so the genealogical record that ends with the Joseph, Mary, Jesus account near the end of Matthew chapter 1, the beginning of chapter 2, is to show a connection of a 1,000-year plan back to David and a 1,000-year plan back to Abraham, and even a much longer plan that goes back to Eve and Adam in Genesis. And so the genealogical record are connecting dots that show that there is a record of people along this line that all have in common not just physical DNA, but spiritual DNA from the standpoint of what God anticipates going to happen to his people. So if you look in chapter 1 and you start reading, it says Adam. Well, who is this Adam? That's Adam, as in the first man, Adam. And so one of the things that's unique about this, we mentioned this in our lesson again on Sunday morning, is that Chronicles goes back to creation and starts with the first human being, as we see Luke does in his genealogy. And so there's a from start of creation to this point in time, in Luke, that point in time, in Chronicles, this point in time, the writer of the Chronicles, that there's a connection to origin of all things physically created, all things with reference to humanity, goes back to Adam. So that's just a huge, huge thing to saying, I'm going to show you how you, the people who are reading Chronicles and what's going on during the time of the period of restoration, which we are going to address in more detail going forward, how this relates to God's eternal plan, enacted and carried out from the mind of God, which he'd always had in mind, Ephesians 3, but now carried out in the context of human history. So Chronicles, this is a creation to Chronicles summarization of individuals. Same sort of thing in Matthew and Luke, especially Luke. This is a creation from Adam to Jesus. And so you need to see how you fit in the larger picture. Israel needed to understand that what they were about as being God's people wasn't just a starting with the Moses kind of thing. It was a this has been in the mind of God from eternity kind of thing. All right, so let's look at the first chapter. Obviously, we're not going to read through all of these names, but you see the genealogy starting with Adam going forward, and at the end of verse 28, it stops with Abraham's sons, Isaac and Ishmael. Isaac is the child of promise, and then family of Ishmael is introduced, verse 29. After Sarah died, Abraham had other children by Keturah. They are mentioned in verse 32 and following. Then it jumps to the family of Isaac, the family of Seir, and the kings of Edom before you get to the end of the chapter. So it's a list of names, all right? List of names from Adam to Japheth, first four verses, descendants of Ham, one of the sons of Noah, descendants of Shem, successive verses, and then from the seed line from Shem to Abraham, Abraham through Ishmael, and then Abraham through Isaac and through Esau. So genealogical records aplenty in chapter 1. All right, chapter 2. This chapter begins the listing of the descendants of Jacob of Israel. So we've just gone further into history. We've gone past Adam to Abraham, the next major figure in God's accounting of things. And now we're going to go from Abraham through Isaac and to Jacob. Just as a reminder, as we're looking at this, our goal is to get up through chapter 6 today. So chapter 1, done. Chapter 2, the listing of the sons of Jacob, and we see them as they're presented in other places, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, so forth. They're listed in the opening two verses. And then verses 3 and following are the descendants of Judah. the descendants of Judah going to David, not just from Judah, but going to David. And then the children of David are chronicled in the very end of that section. So again, huge, huge swaths of genealogy connecting us eventually to what's going to be going on during the time of the children of Israel as they are in the period of restoration. All right, so sons of Jacob, Israel, first two verses. The rest of them are descendants of Judah's son, Judah's sons, leading to the point of David in the Davidic kingdom. Now, just a reminder, what's all this huge? It's going through all of this, and then it's going to zoom in on David. So you go from Adam to Abraham, and Abraham to Jacob. So that's his grandson. Isaac is in between Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Jacob becomes Israel, Genesis chapter 32. And then he has 12 sons. But all of those sons, as significant as they are in different aspects of genealogical records in Genesis 49 and Genesis 50, and as brought out in other genealogical records throughout the text, the focus is on Judah because the scepter is going to be there. That is the right to rule. The four son, not Reuben, not Simeon, not Levi, but Judah. And so now there's going to be a huge, huge, huge Davidic emphasis on seed line. And so the descendants of Judah, because Judah is the forerunner, the precursor of the king David, and it's his seed line that's going to continue to the time of the Christ that brings forth Joseph, Mary, Jesus. All right. So chapter 3 continues to discuss the genealogy of Judah. We get there at the end of chapter 2, and then that's going to be emphasized even more in chapter 3. The descendants of David, first 9 verses, the descendants of Solomon, who is, of course, the first son of David to reign on the throne. And so all of those are spelled out as you get into chapter 3. All right. So chapter 3, you have sons of David. Here, the ones that were born to him in Hebron, where he first reigned for about 7.5 years. And then those that are born later. So the who is born to which wife is so forth is spelled out. These are all mentioned here. And then Solomon comes on the scene in verse 10. His son Rehoboam and the continuation of sons. And going all the way down to Jeconiah and Zedekiah. And just as a point of emphasis, that's not all the kings of Judah. It's just hit the highlights of the kings that are mentioned here. So it doesn't mention all the good kings, doesn't mention all the bad kings. It just mentions a synopsis, summary of kings from Solomon to Zedekiah. And who are these kings after that? Well, these are the ones who were kings in name, but not kings in actual rule. All right. So chapter 3 ends with kings who are Davidic in their seed line, in their genealogy, but they are not reigning. That is, they're not serving as kings anymore. Again, when we get into the book of Jeremiah, we're going to see that that's going to be spelled out. In the book of Jeremiah, we will see that Jeremiah mentions specifically that after this particular king, Jeremiah 22, I think it is, when we get there, after this particular king, nobody else is going to sit upon the throne again. Doesn't mean there won't be a king line continuing, but nobody's going to be reigning anymore. All right, so that's chapter 3. Chapter 4 continues the lineage of Jacob or Israel. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 23 lists further descendants of Judah. And then 24 through 43 continues the genealogy of Jacob through Simeon. So again, lots of genealogical records as we get into First Chronicles. It's not going to stop. For 9 chapters, we're going to see nothing but genealogical records of Adam leading to David, leading to Judah, and then leading to David and beyond that to bring us to the point of where the children of Israel are in their history. So again, connecting them to what God intended. So there are other children that are listed. Obviously, Judah is centric, even though Judah is not the firstborn. He's most important because of the seed line. But now we're going to go back a little bit and see that the genealogy of Jacob, also known as Israel, through Simeon is chronicled at the end of chapter 4. And when we begin chapter 5, the genealogy continues, only now it's the descendants of Reuben. He's the firstborn son. And that goes through the first 10 verses. You start in verse 11 and you see the genealogy of Gad. That goes down through verse 22. Then in verse 23 and following, we're going to see genealogy of some of the tribes on the eastern side. Remember, 2.5 tribes inherited land on that other side of the river. So verses 18 and following, we're going to start with that. Verses 23 and following, we're going to focus on Manasseh. So you see a brief history of those 2.5 tribes that inherited land on the opposite side of the Jordan, on the eastern side. And so remember, we need to note that even though these tribes were not part of either the kingdom of Judah or the kingdom of Israel, that they had counterparts in Israel. All right, they too, they were separated geographically, but they were not supposed to be separated spiritually speaking. And so they are also carried into captivity. Anyway, their genealogical record is given. We get to the last chapter for today's reading, which is chapter 6. And again, we're going through these first 6 chapters that bring us up to where we're supposed to be for May 10th, Sunday, May 10th. We're able to go through them so quickly because it's just genealogical records. And I don't mean just genealogical records as if it's not important, but because we can read through the names of the list. We don't see any events, very little. Don't see any major principles. We just see genealogical records that's going to be connections from what happened before to what's going to happen in the future. So the first section starts with the family of Levi. He had 3 sons, Gershon, Kohath, Merari. Sons of Kohath are going to be mentioned, and they're going to be spelled out. Amram and the 3 significant individuals, Aaron and Moses and Miriam, the 2 brothers and the sister, and then the rest of the tribe of Levi. Also, those who were serving in the house of the Lord, the musicians and so forth, they are chronicled starting in verse 31. Aaron's specific genealogy as a descendant of Levi, where he came from is from Levi to Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And the sons of Kohath were, and then Amram was one, so it's Levi, and then Kohath, and then Amram, so we're 2 generations down now. And then the sons of Amram were Aaron and Moses, and Miriam was the daughter. And so that follows the genealogical tree there. But then the rest of the family of Aaron, starting in verse 49 and going through verse 53, is listed. And then finally, chapter 6 does something different in that it's not just genealogical records, but now they're geographical records. What are those geographical records? Well, verse 54 tells us these are the dwelling places throughout their settlements in their territory, for they were given by lot to the sons of Aaron of the family of the Kohathites. So these are the Levitical cities, the dwelling places of the children of Levi. And so it's going to mention all these places where they were and how many cities were given to each one in the confines of which particular tribe of all the 12 tribes where they were dwelling. 11 tribes, 11. There are 12 tribes. Remember, Joseph receives a double portion through Ephraim and Manasseh. And so that's still 12. Levi's inheritance is in the midst of all of them. So that's it. That's nothing but lots of lists when we get to the 6th chapter, which is where we left off in our reading. So on Sunday morning, May the 17th in our class, we will take up very quickly moving through the next few genealogical records in chapter 7, chapter 8, and into chapter 9. And then we're going to see some repetition from what we see in Samuel. And again, remember, 50% of Chronicles is repetition of what we see in Samuel. And then we will come back into some more significant things as we get further into the writings of Chronicles. All right, so we're going to wrap up now. This is a review of the latter part of 2 Kings. We left off at chapter 21. We started in chapter 22, summarized 2 Kings, introduced 1 Chronicles, and in order to keep up with our reading through Sunday, May 10th, we surveyed through the first six chapters of 1 Chronicles. More to come next week. Hope you can join us then.